former President Jimmy Carter on the Boone Erickson Show this morning. President Carter has a new book called The Blood of Abraham, Insights into the Middle East.
That's why he's here? I thought he came especially for our show.
Well, he did. We had him on the phone a while back. What was it, a year and a half ago?
I wrote the book so I could get another invitation.
That's the reason, sure.
Hey, you are in Minnesota, the only state that voted Democratic in the last election. Do you feel comfortable?
I feel comfortable, yes. And they also voted for me when I ran both times.
That's right, right. Jimmy Carter indeed has a book called The Blood of Abraham, and it's a fascinating history, a real look at all the parties involved in that troubled area of the world. But the Middle East is kind of off the front pages lately. There has been the withdrawal lately, but do you think you timed this right as far as interest?
Well, the Middle East will be back on the front pages. It depends on whether it's on the front pages because you've finished the Camp David Accords and a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. Or will it be on the front pages because there's another war? I hope it'll be on the front pages because President Reagan and Secretary Schultz have moved into the peace process.
As far as the Middle East was concerned, the administration before you, there was the shuttle diplomacy of Henry Kissinger and, of course, yes, the Camp David meetings that you had. What is happening today?
Nothing.
All right. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, it's true. The only adventure that President Reagan has launched in the Middle East is to send the Marines into Lebanon, which turned out to be a real tragedy. And I think since that time, there's been a decision made by the White House not to participate in the peace process itself, but to leave the Arabs and Israelis to shift for themselves until they demonstrate a massive move toward peace, which I think, as expressed in the book, is impossible without our help. They just can't move it so far.
The objectives during your presidency and presidents before you in the Middle East, what were they in?
Well, they were quite compatible. What we did during the time of the shuttle diplomacy and later during the time of Camp David was to let the Mideast leaders take one step, a small step, toward peace, and they always knew that they had an eager partner in the White House and in the State Department to join in with them to proceed a little bit further if possible. And that was a reassuring thing to the moderates in the Middle East on both sides who did want to make progress. But that's what's been missing for the last 4 years, and that's very disturbing to me, I think, and also to the leaders in the Middle East. You remember, within this last month, President Mubarak made a special trip to Washington to urge President Reagan to respond to the more recent statement from the Jordanians and Palestinians in accordance with the Camp David Accords. But he went home, according to the news media, empty-handed.
What's the greatest obstacle to peace in the Middle East, in your judgment?
Well, there are two ultimate goals. One is for Israel to have a secure and peaceful existence, recognized by our neighbors. The other one is Palestinian rights and the Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. That's easy to say, but difficult to achieve. And I think the obstacle is among the leadership. As Sadat often said very wisely, the people in the Middle East want peace. That is, the Palestinians, the Israelis, even the Syrians. The obstacle is the leaders. We don't have the boldness or the willingness on any part of any leader in the United States or the Middle East to kind of take a chance to say, I'm going to move, even though I might suffer some political damage. We need another Sadat.
His untimely death made a big difference.
Well, it did. I think that Mubarak, a very cautious man, a very competent man, has basically done what Sadat would have done. You know, to try to re-cement Egypt's ties to the Arab nations, to honor the terms of the peace treaty with Israel, and to try to encourage the Palestinians and Jordanians to join in the process. And he's been quite enthusiastic about this. But as Sadat only comes along once in a lifetime, where a man has a broad, strategic, worldwide vision, a great generosity at the negotiating table on details which are not significant, and who's willing to risk his political life and even his own life, if necessary, for peace.
He always sounded so warm to you.
Well, he was. He and Jehan were among the closest friends of me and Rosalind, and his children were my children's friends, and his grandchildren were my grandchildren's friends. You know, we couldn't have had a closer relationship with a foreign leader than we had with Sadat. It was only a few weeks before he was assassinated that he came down to Plains to to visit us in our home. He told me at that time, interestingly now, that he was going to step down from the presidency the following April, in that Mubarak habit, that Mubarak was now ready to take over the reins of leadership. But it wasn't long before he was dead.
I can still see the three of you standing there after the Camp David Accords, and he would say, it was Jimmy Carter. Just stands in your memory. The interesting thing is now that the Camp David Accords have withstood some of these challenges of the past couple of years, haven't they?
Yes, well, a lot of people forget that the Camp David Accords were just an outline or a framework. What really was difficult was 6 months later to conclude the peace treaty. And that's one of the results, and some other parts of Camp David have not been pursued. But the peace treaty has withstood some very severe tests. First of all, the traumatic experience of Israel to withdraw from the Sinai and to dismantle Israeli settlements that Begin had sworn never to do. The next big test, of course, was Sadat's death. And the third big test was the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. But in spite of all that, the treaty is still there.
We're going to break for weather for just a moment, okay?
Good.
President Carter with us. He has a new book called The Blood of Abraham, Insights into the Middle East. And we'll talk some more about this on the Boone Erickson Show here on CCO Radio in just a minute or so. It's 14 minutes past 9 right now.
Sit back, it feels so good, just like we said it would. You're on your way now, it feels so satisfying.
Starting April 28th, you can fly Republic's new nonstops to San Diego and Dallas-Fort Worth. And when you do, you'll get perks. Perks like Republic's exclusive business first section. For just a few dollars over their non-discounted coach fare, you'll be first on, first off, get two across, wide seating, free drinks, and more. And with Republic's frequent flyer perk, you'll get a free round trip anywhere they fly after just 20,000 miles. Fly to Dallas-Fort Worth nonstop before June 15th, and they'll even double your mileage. For information and reservations on Republic's new nonstops to San Diego and Dallas, Fort Worth, call your travel agent or Republic Airlines.
Say this hour in Twins Drive 85, if you hear your name on the air, you could win a CCO Radio Summer Fun Prize Package
to Plains, Georgia.
So stay tuned. A guest of the former president?
That's right. No,
it doesn't say that.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
No, but it's a nice prize package just the same. We'll hear about that. Let's go to the Weather Center, and Bill Anderson's our meteorologist. Bill, it's a little cool for Georgia people, although they found it, I'm sure, invigorating as they stepped off the plane. What do we have in store?
We have in store more of the same, Charlie. 43 degrees right now, our temperature. It's a chilly March-like day. I should say to our visitors that April is usually a little bit warmer than this in Minnesota. But right now we're looking at a low-pressure system off to our southwest that is pulling in. You can say, how can the wind be northeast when the storm's coming from the southwest? Well, that storm to the southwest is pulling in some colder air that's now up over Canada, and that's keeping our temperatures cool. Cloudy conditions prevailing because of upper atmospheric disturbances. Radar showing light rain across northern Iowa and into southeastern Minnesota to the southeast of Rochester. Just a slight chance those showers could get as far north as central Minnesota later on today, but a little better chance of scattered showers over the weekend. Newest indications are that this low-pressure center is going to be a slow-moving one. We just might escape the rain and keep it off to the southwest during the weekend. Just a questionable weekend. Listen in for the forecast during the next couple days. Our Twin Cities forecast is for cloudy skies through tomorrow, a chance of showers this afternoon and tonight, and a little better chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow. Highs today will get up to maybe 53 degrees. Low tonight, 45. High tomorrow, about 58. Chance of rain is 30% this afternoon and tonight, 40% tomorrow. Winds will be northeast 10 to 20. Right now in Cambridge, it's mostly cloudy, 41. New Prague, cloudy, 44. And in Plains, Georgia, in western Georgia, on Highway 280 between Americus and Archery, it's sunny. A light northeast breeze is blowing, and the temperature, this is great, 77 degrees already. And in the Twin Cities, we have cloudy skies, wind north at 15 miles per hour, steady barometer, 31 is the dew point. The temperature is 43.
Exciting news. Now factory-sponsored 8.8% financing on Pontiac Fieros and Sunbirds. Save hundreds of dollars in finance charges at Wally McCarthy Pontiac GMC in White Bear.
43 degrees now and 18 minutes past 9 o'clock.
So do you know why the people at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota created Aware Gold?
Well, I guess it's because people always need more health care protection.
And it's also because they want everyone to have the right kind of health care protection.
Hey, tell me, how can Aware Gold be right for everybody?
Glad you asked that question.
I knew you had the answer.
It's affordable. And you can see any Aware Gold doctor in Minnesota and get 100% coverage for preventive care, like checkups and well baby care,
How about physician? Do they file the claims, or do you have to file?
The physicians take care
of it. They take care of the paperwork?
Don't worry about
that's terrific.
You go in, see the doctor, show your card, walk out, no paperwork.
Fantastic. How about deductibles?
Deductibles?
There aren't any.
Aren't any?
No deductibles. Sounds to me like Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota really worked hard to make Aware Gold the right kind of protection for Minnesota.
So they really care about people, those Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota people do, and then they make our lives better.
Well, they're responsive, innovative, committed to care. That's the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota difference. Give them a call. Call your Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota broker for more information.
Former President Jimmy Carter is with us on the Boone and Erickson show today, live and in person, and we really appreciate that. He has a new book called The Blood of Abraham, Insights into the Middle East, and could we talk about that title just a bit?
Be fine. A very fine young Minnesota woman devised a title. Her name is Molly Russoff. She works with Houghton Mifflin. I had thought about calling it The Sons of Abraham or something like that to show that we all shared a common heritage, both in religious beliefs and in the sight of God. But I think the blood of Abraham adds something to it. It indicates also that we're children of Abraham, that we share the same blood. But the blood means that there's still an unnecessary, massive bloodshed in that region, which ought to be the symbolism of peace.
You reminded us in the book of how much Abraham got around through the Middle East.
I know. One of the most interesting things in writing the book was to trace Abraham's tracks, looking at modern-day politics and where he went through from what's presently Iraq into Syria, up in the northern part, down through Damascus. And I was in Damascus preparing this book. Then he went down through what's presently Lebanon, the Baca Valley area, crossed the Jordan River from Jordan into Israel, found a great famine there, went down to Egypt, where the Pharaoh took a liking to Abraham and his nephew Lot. And then he came back to Canaan, or the Promised Land, and then there got his promises from God.
In your book, you have a capsule history of the whole Middle East going back to thousands of years before Christ.
Yes, and coming up to January of this year.
And then you also go into history and your own involvement in it in the regular text, including your first time to Israel when you were governor.
That's right. That was an exciting trip. I went over there as governor, as a guest of Mrs. Meir, who was the prime minister, and we just set our own itinerary, traveled around the country, and learned a lot that came in handy for me when I went into the White House.
So you had an early interest in the area, and of course with your Bible study.
Sure. Well, my interest in this area started 56 years ago when I was 4 years old, and I learned about Abraham and Moses, David, Solomon, even before I learned about Dick and Jane playing with a puppy dog in the first grade reader.
and you talked religion,
yes,
with Sadat as well as Begin.
More with Sadat. Sadat was quite intrigued with Judaism and with Christianity and how it interrelated with the Islamic world. And he would often say, in my presence, and a few times when Begin was there too, don't forget that we are both sons of Abraham. And Begin was a little bit nervous about that. But Sadat made a big deal of it.
But both Begin and Sadat were devout.
Deeply
men.
Religious. Yes, and I think that one of the interesting things in the book, which, by the way, is very brief. As you know, it's only about 200 pages. It would have been a lot easier to write a 1,000-page book. But one of the intriguing things is that there's an interrelationship of religion that does potentially bind us together, but the fanatics in all three faiths look upon themselves as ordained by God, sometimes to commit acts of terrorism, and even the loss of life of completely innocent people on all sides is looked upon as carrying out the will of God.
Do we need another crisis in the area before something is done?
I pray not. I pray not. I think that we now have some very moderate leaders there who are eager to see the United States join the process. King Hussein in Jordan, I think Prime Minister Peres in Israel, although he has a divided government, and Mubarak in Egypt, all heads of nations, very eager to proceed with the peace process.
Say, we'll talk some more about President Carter's book, The Blood of Abraham, in just a few moments. A lot of calls come in, and people want to know about other things, what you think of the situation, the trip to Germany with President Reagan.
Gee, maybe we ought to ask that next.
Maybe. And also Nixon's decision, former President Nixon's decision, to dismiss his Secret Service and to provide for his own security. And we'll get some comments on that, too. 23 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's 43 degrees in our Twin Cities, north wind at 15, here on CCO Radio. And another name has been drawn. Another name's been drawn in the WCCO Radio Amoco CertiCare Twins Drive 85 contest.
Here's the name, Jimmy Carter, Rural Route, Plains, Georgia.
No. These initials are BB of Minneapolis on Pillsbury Avenue, 4322 Pillsbury, actually. Betty Bajorgi?
Sounds good to me.
B-J-O-R-G-E. And if Betty will call us within 8 minutes and 30 seconds at 332-7600, Betty will win a pair of tickets to the Twins' New York game on May 8th. Compliments of the Radisson Hotel Metrodome, located at Seven Corners in Minneapolis at 35W and Washington. Also, a pair of tickets to the Metropolitan Opera's May 14th performance of Tchaikovsky. Eugene Onegin, a colorful and tuneful grand opera at Northrop Auditorium, and a $20 certificate for True Value Hardware, a prize package valued over $130. That's Betty Bajorgi. Hope that's the way she pronounces her name. B-J-O-R-G-E.
Bajorgi? Could it be Bjorgi?
Bjorgi. I bet that's Bjorgi. Betty should phone us right now at 332-7600. It's part of Twins Drive 85.
That's where Mondale is in Norway there, President Carter.
Right now he's in Norway. Yeah.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah, is that a, he hasn't talked to many news people or anything. He hasn't even appeared on our program.
Well.
So that shows he's not... Tell us...
Have you talked to him?
Yes, several times within the last couple of weeks. He's getting along fine.
Is he all right? He's coming out of the... He had to be down.
Well, he was down for a while, but, you know, that was way last November. And here it is, April. He's a very resilient and a very strong person, and I think he's taken it. And he also has a great sense of humor.
Did you tell him what you thought he did wrong?
Not really. I think no one needs to tell him. it was just a time, you know, in our nation's history when I don't think anyone could have beaten Ronald Reagan.
You mentioned a sense of humor. He has a great sense of humor. We've had him on many times throughout the time he was Attorney General here in Minnesota, a Senator, and Vice President.
Yes.
And yet, that humor did not come out the same way when he campaigned. It might have helped him, do you think?
I know. I think he feels a little stiff on television. And it came across that he wasn't very humorous. Of course, he didn't have a lot to laugh about that entire year. I think he was more humorous after the first debate than he was any other time, because he felt, you know, that a great stimulus there from having done so well. But, you know, sometimes it's hard to smile when things are going the wrong way. But he and Joan, you know, a great... political couple, and I think in the heritage of Hubert Humphrey, and it was an inspiration to me to work with him.
Do you find that television is going to elect our presidents in the future?
No, I don't think
so. You have to be a television personality to become president?
I think that President Reagan's mastery of acting and television is wearing thin now. He's been remarkably successful in the political world, particularly because he's never been willing to take the blame for anything. He's always separated himself from anything that was unpleasant or distasteful or politically unpopular or associated with disappointment or failure. And he's always been very eager and very successful in shifting the responsibility to someone else. And he chooses the persons to be blamed very carefully. Sometimes it's a Republican Senate, sometimes it's a Democratic House, sometimes it's the news media, sometimes it's his own cabinet officers. Quite often, it's his predecessors in office, not just me, but Nixon and Ford. And I know for a fact that some of them quite often get angry with him. So I think in this present embarrassing situation, he's been casting around to find somebody to blame for his problem. But I think the fact is, in this instance, that in spite of the contrary advice from his staff members and advisors in the State Department and otherwise, and even in the Congress with Senator Dole, he's made the decision himself. And I think alone he has persisted in his plans to visit the Nazi cemetery.
Do you think it's made a difference because Baker went to the Treasury and Reagan became his chief of staff?
I have my own personal opinion that this is a decision not affected by staff members. I think it's a decision made by Ronald Reagan. And it's intriguing to me that people tend to say, well, it must not be his fault. Surely it's Mr. Reagan's fault, you know, Reagan's fault. Surely it's somebody else's fault. I think it's his fault. And it could be over in an hour. All he has to do is to call a press conference and say, look, I made a mistake. I'm not going to the Nazi cemetery. I'm going to do something else to show my friendship with the German people. And there would be no adverse consequences between us and West Germany. and the whole Fuhrer would be over, you know, that day.
I'm sure you have differences with the present president. Do you agree with anything he's done?
Well, yes, I think in the Mideast thing, as I said in the book, he made a wonderful speech in September 1982 and endorsed the Camp David Accords in their entirety and voiced his opinion, with which I happen to agree, that they ought not to be an independent Palestinian nation, but a confederation between the West Bank and Gaza. So I agree with that completely. And I, in fact, I quote his entire speech, which is not too long, in the appendix to the book, along with the Camp David Accords and some other things. And I think that he's been right and sometimes quite courageous in not encouraging the erection of trade barriers and protectionist features to minimize incoming products that hold down the inflation rate. That's been difficult for him. I think he's done it well.
Say, Charlie Osgood is generally on at this time with his program from CBS, but we're going to delay Charlie for about half an hour and take him just after 10 so that we can continue our discussions with former President Jimmy Carter, whose new book, The Blood of Abraham, has just been published by Houlton Mifflin Company, and it's in your bookstore.
We talked about the Iranian rescue attempt with keeping the faith. Anything that you've learned new since about that that time? I think I read somewhere where you said, if only we had one more helicopter.
Well, if people ask me, what would you have done differently? I would have said I'd have sent one more helicopter to Desert One. But I think even in all the Monday morning quarterback analyses of the hostage crisis, no one has ever suggested anything that we could have done differently or better. I was surprised maybe 2 weeks ago when the New York Times commissioned a poll of the American people. I think the ROPA organization did it among several thousand Americans. And among the top three most notable diplomatic achievements in recent years was the Camp David Accords, which was not surprising. But the other one in the top three was the way the hostage crisis was handled with Iran, which was a pleasant surprise for me. Because at the time there was a lot of criticism. People didn't really know what was happening behind the scenes. But I think as they've analyzed it, as Americans have absorbed the truth and realized that under the most difficult circumstances, all the hostages were protected, their lives, their health, and they came home to freedom. I'm pleased to see that now it's not a blight on American diplomacy, but something considered to be an achievement.
President Carter, if the Shah of Iran had not come to the United States for medical treatment in his final days, had he gone to another country, would that have precipitated the hostage crisis in the first place?
It's hard to say, you know, what precipitated it. Every day, as you know, there were demonstrations on the streets of Iran. The Ayatollah Khomeini was stirring them up. Even when I finally decided reluctantly to let the Shah come in for treatment, when I was convinced not only by his own doctors and the ones in New York, but also the doctors in the State Department, his only chance for life was to come to the Kettering Center in New York and for diagnosis and perhaps treatment. I decided without hesitation, invite him in. We then notified the Prime Minister of Iran, who was a very solid and a strong man, his name was Bazargan, what we were going to do. And he said, well, it might cause some disturbance in Tehran when that happens, but we'll protect your people here and the embassy. So the Shah came in, a few militants went into the embassy. Bazargan began to move to remove the militants from the embassy. But Khomeini sent his son there. His son endorsed what the kidnappers were doing. Instantly, they became national heroes. Bazargan, by the way, resigned in protest. So it's hard to say whether something like that would have happened if the Shah had not come in. I don't really know.
Do you wish you'd supported the Shah more strongly?
No, we supported the Shah as strongly as was humanly and politically possible throughout his difficult years. And the only thing we didn't do was we didn't send American troops into Iran to try to support a regime that had really lost its popularity among a wide range of Iranian people. But we gave the Shah every possible support. And he acknowledged it at the time. And I think that it's fair to say in retrospect that the Shah did have some human rights abuses within his regime. But they fade into relative insignificance when compared with a horrible bloodshed and abuse that's come under the radical, fanatic Khomeini.
You're satisfied that the whole problem in that rescue attempt was, you know, the things that happened to the helicopters and so on, was pure happenstance?
I think that's accurate to say, yes.
Had it been successful, and there evidently was a good chance of success, what would it have meant to you, do you think?
Well, it would have been a much more pleasant 1980 with a victory in November. What people tend to forget after the listening to Ronald Reagan for 4 years is he only got 51%, and it was not a landslide victory. It's not an endorsement of his policies. And I think there was a great deal of discouragement and frustration throughout the country because of the hostage crisis, the fact that it couldn't be resolved rapidly. I felt the frustration perhaps more than any American. And this was a single major handicap in my reelection campaign. So I think if the hostage rescue team had been successful, you know, I would have been a hero at least long enough to defeat Reagan.
The Panama Canal thing, there were a lot of dire forecasts about what would happen. What's happened?
It's one of the most beautiful things that ever happened to our country and to Central America. The Panama Canal treaties have served their purpose. We have a very sound relationship with Panama. The canal is open and prospering. We have reserved all the rights to defend the canal against any outside threat and also to let our ships go through expeditiously, even throughout the next century. And I think this has been a stabilizing factor in Central America, even, to have Panama there, a solid country, which has now shifted from a military dictatorship to a full democracy because of its treaties.
Say, we're going to have a message, and then we'll be back with the president. Herb just called from somewhere in our CCO land and said, are the Carter Worm Farms in Plains, Georgia, your farms?
No, I wish they were. They're very, it's a very lucrative business.
They have a lot of ads, don't
That's
they?
That's my first cousin, yes.
Is that right? Hugh
Carter. Your first cousin?
Yes.
Maybe it was Billy. What's Billy doing these days?
Billy is doing great. He's getting rich. He's a top executive officer of one of the finest companies in South Georgia. Hasn't had a drink in 6 years. He and his wife do a lot of work with Alcoholics Anonymous, warning people about the affliction that he had when I was president. As a matter of fact, he's got a very beautiful daughter who's going to be married in Plains tomorrow.
Really?
Her name is Marley.
And
yes.
He stayed away from the Libyans.
And he stayed away from the Libyans, but he's really doing great.
That's terrific. Now, your own daughter.
Yes, Amy.
Has been involved in some demonstrations.
That's right.
Are you in favor of that, or does it...
Well, I'm very proud of Amy. She didn't consult me ahead of time, contrary to the news reports. And I was surprised when I discovered that she had been arrested. But Amy has had... first of all, let me say that Amy is an extremely well-informed young woman.
How old is she now?
17. She'll be 18 next October. She's a senior in high school. Secondly, she has had an interest in the apartheid question since she was in the sixth grade when she wrote her annual theme paper on apartheid in South Africa and what a terrible blow it was to international human rights. So Amy did call home. I wasn't there. And she talked to Rosalind and told her that she was planning to demonstrate in front of the South African embassy. And Rosen said, well, I think if you feel deeply about it, go ahead. And Amy said there was a chance for her to be arrested, but they only arrest about 2 or 3 out of every 2 or 3,000. So Rosen didn't think that was very likely. But then the following day, which was Easter weekend, Amy was arrested. And I'm proud that Amy was willing to be embarrassed in order to show her concern about this apartheid.
Do you think it was unfair, the flack you got from the media about quoting Amy as far as world peace, or was it the possibility
nuclear,
of nuclear...
nuclear weapon. Well, I thought it was unfair.
It seems to me it's something that children today, young people, are very concerned about.
And Amy was right. You know, it's one of the major concerns. But it was kind of ridiculed at the time. But there again, you know, when people thought about a 12-year-old child... A lot of 12-year-old children don't understand about MIRV'd missiles and what negotiations had been and what the SALT II and ABM. Amy was thoroughly familiar with all those things, almost as well as, you know, as an average adult. And she said that among her school children, even school classmates, one of the biggest concerns about the future was nuclear war. And so when I said that, maybe in an unconvincing way, it was ridiculed.
And I believe that sometimes you were criticized for using Rosalind as an advisor, but sure. It's obvious that most presidents ask their wives what they think.
Certainly. Well, you name it, I was criticized for it. But I survived.
You got it right there. President Carter with us on CCO, and the former president visiting here in the Twin Cities on behalf of his book, The Blood of Abraham, and we'll hear more about that in just a moment. 22 minutes now before 10 o'clock, it's 43 degrees. 20 minutes now before 10, 43 degrees in our Twin Cities. I wonder if former president has a wool rest.
A wool rest mattress, I would think so, if he really wants to get a good night's sleep.
I imagine the former president sleeps well, but if he... if he goes out and jogs or does anything athletic, and I'm sure he does, and has a little pain or any reason at all?
Well, this is the right time, you know. You can get up to $70 on the genuine 100% Wool Rest wool mattress pads that guarantee a better night's sleep. There's no cheaper sleeper.
Oh, no. Wool Rest can be washed or dry cleaned, unlike the sleepers that have foam rubber backings, and it has more wool. The queen size weighs 10 full pounds.
And no imitation works as well as Wool Rest. Hey, buy one for Mom on Mother's Day.
Hey, Mom's Day's coming up.
Have Mom sleep on it for 90 nights, unless she works 90 days.
90 days.
If at the end of that time she isn't sleeping better, simply return it to Slumberland for a full refund.
And you got nothing to lose. And now you can enjoy Mother's Day savings of $30 to $70 during the first and maybe only Wool Rest sleeper sale.
Supplies are limited. Sale ends May 12th, so hurry!
Save on the genuine Wool Rest sleeper at all the Slumberland stores throughout the Twin Cities area. You might check the white pages for the Slumberland store nearest you.
It happens twice a year, once in April and once again in October. Twice a year, someone in the Twin Cities turns the automobile business completely upside down. And twice a year, 80 people drive home a real bargain. The sale is on at Win Stevens Buick AMC Jeep and Renault. In the next 4 days, Win Stevens will liquidate over 80 low-mile 1984 and 1985 demonstrators, house cars and executive cars. Save nearly $6,000 on Mr. Stevens' personal Riviera, up to $3,200 on Grand Wagoneers, or up to $1,800 on Centuries. And with Renault prices starting at just $6,238, there's something for everyone. So don't miss this all-out sellout of our tryouts. See Friday's Star and Tribune classified section for a complete listing of vehicles and prices. And remember, Win Stevens will never be undersold. The demo sale extravaganza ends Tuesday, April 30th at Win Stevens Buick AMC Jeep and Renault on Highway 100 in St. Louis Park.
43 right now in our Twin Cities. We're getting up into the 50s, maybe close to 60. It's a lovely day, 18 minutes now before 10 o'clock, and former President Carter with us on the Boone Erickson Show on Real Radio. Question from a listener about, have to ask it before you leave, because a lot of people have been calling about it, because of the announcement that former President Nixon, has dismissed his Secret Service or is in the process of doing it and providing his own security. How do you feel about that?
I think it's good for him. As you know, his wife is not able to go out anymore, and he's cut down his activities tremendously. Also, President Nixon is a very wealthy man, and he's able to phase out his Secret Service and maybe hire even some of the same agents and pay them out of his own pocket. So I think that's a good move for him. It's not a matter of death threats that makes the Secret Service valuable to a former president. It would be almost impossible to lead a normal life or to have any privacy without some sort of, protection, some sort of way to keep people out of a house all night. My mother had to move out of Plains, and my brother had to move out of Plains. Mama would quite often, when she was 82 or 3 years old and trying to live in the little town, at 10 o'clock at night, people would knock on her door, and she would get up out of bed and go to the door, and they'd say, "Miss Lillian, we hate to wake you up in the middle of the night, but we just want you to know we're in Plains. When your son first started running his campaign, he came to our town, and we helped arrange a reception for him. And is it okay if we come in and have a cup of coffee with you and just talk about how Jimmy's getting along?" And, you know, this is an almost impossible thing to turn people away because they're your old buddies. So for privacy and also for security and for the ability to move around, even in foreign countries, it's absolutely necessary, I think. And the main cost of a former presence, to respond to one other criticism, is a cost of the presidential libraries. And the opponents of former presidents always say this is how much it costs to support former presidents. It is a terrible burden for me as a Democrat. I've had to raise $25 million in private contributions in this country and around the world to build a library to house all the documents, records, communication, mementos of my administration. And I have deeded all those to the federal government. Once the building is finished, about a year from now, then the federal government will operate that library in perpetuity, and people can visit it, scholars, historians, biographers, because that's all those documents, that's the only place they can be stored. And this is what the cost amounts to. But it would have pleased me greatly if the federal government had permitted these documents and records to be stored somewhere in Washington.
Is that in Atlanta, the library?
It will be in Atlanta, yes.
How do you find privacy with your wife and family?
Well, we live, as I say, in a small town, and we have about a 170-acre farm just on the edge of Plains, and we have the only house on the farm.
So you still live in Plains?
Yes, and we always will, I hope. My people and Rosen's people, who were born in the 1700s, lived in worked and died and are buried in Plains. So when I told a group of students that one night at a rally when I was trying to get a lot of support, and somebody said, Mr. President, you say you still live in Plains? And I said, yes. Yeah. Well, you haven't got very far in life, have you? Well, that's true. But it's our home, and you know, we feel good there.
Tourists still stop through Plains?
Oh, yeah. They don't come there in the thousands like they used to, but they come there in the dozens and hundreds. And we're glad to see them, but we also have to live a normal life.
Do you have any livestock there?
Not really. I got out of the livestock business when I went off to be governor. I had livestock on a partnership basis, and when I lived in Atlanta, 120 miles away, I found out that every time a cow or a hog died, it was my animal, and every time one sold for a pretty good price, it was my partner's animal. So I decided just to sell out. But we still take care of our farms, mostly timberland, and on our farm, there still is peanuts, cotton, soybeans and wheat. We produce those crops.
The plight of the farmer, of course, is very close to us because of the agriculture area we live in.
And it's horrible. The nation and the world does not know how bad off the farmers are in this country. It is really bad. Since I've been home in 4 years, farm values around my area have dropped more than 50%. And I noticed in a Wall Street Journal article recently that in 1984, on a nationwide basis, farm values dropped 15%, likely to drop 10 more percent this year. We've had more bankruptcies in our area than they had during the Great Depression. And I think this has been one of the things that is dragging down the banking system of our country. There are about 1,200 officially troubled banks now, something we haven't seen in more than 50 years. And I think it's going to get worse with President Reagan's economic policies. It's almost certain even to get worse.
What should be done?
Well, the main thing is to cut the deficit. And what President Reagan has done, I think, is to deliberately create enormous deficits. And by the end of this year, the Reagan debt will equal all the national debt from George Washington through me. And what caused it, of course, is his insistence the first year he was in office, when he absolutely controlled the Congress, to give a $750 billion reduction in tax payments, which benefited mostly the wealthy people of our country. And his insistence on extraordinarily high and unnecessary defense expenditures has been the other key item in the creation of this enormous deficit. And he's been unwilling even to this moment to yield on either item, either to increase federal revenue by closing loopholes and letting those people pay more taxes, or to reduce the enormous defense expenditures. I think the Congress is now forcing him to make some concessions on the latter, but he's done it very reluctantly.
Speaking of agriculture,
Chuck Lilligren had his picture taken with you in Washington, one time President Carter, and he's wondering why you haven't sent him a card at Christmas time anymore. But here he is, Chuck Lilligren, with the Ag Report.
Thank you, Raj. On the Chicago Board of Trade, May corn at 284 is up a half this morning. May wheat, 351 and a half, up three quarters. May soybeans, 596 and a quarter, down two. May soy oil, 3325, down 33. May soy meal, 123.70, up 60. May oats, December oats, $1.63, unchanged. Kansas City, May wheat, 344 and a quarter is bid. Minneapolis, May, 377, down a quarter. On the Mercantile Exchange, June live cattle, 6290, up 18. May feeder cattle, 6507, asked. June hogs, 4690, up 10. May bellies, 6465, up 18. At South St. Paul, the Holstein steers, 51 to 53. Slaughter cows, 41, occasional 42. Bulls, 52, a few 53. 240-pound barrels and gelts, 40 and a half, a few 41. Light sows, 37 to 38. Heavies, 39 to 40. Boars, 35 and a half. Wool lamb, 62 to 64. Shorn in spring, 66 to 70. Cash forwards are set strong to a quarter higher on the live cattle. June, 60. August, 61 and a quarter. October, 60. Feeder cattle, May, 62 and a quarter. August, 65 and a half. September, 65 and a half. Those are steady to a quarter higher. And the live hog cash forwards are quarter higher. June, 44. July, 45.75. August, 46.
Wednesday, April 30th, 1975. The Saigon government surrenders unconditionally to the Viet Cong. 2 hours earlier, the United States ends 2 decades of military involvement in the Vietnam War as it evacuates the last American from South Vietnam. Sunday, April 28th, 1985. The Minneapolis Star and Tribune publishes the first of its three-part series entitled Vietnam, 10 Years After the Fall. The series examines how the Vietnam conflict has affected and is still affecting the lives of of people in Minnesota and across the country. Learn how Minnesota families are still fighting the loss of a husband, brother, father, a son. How veterans are fighting wounds, both psychological and physical. How Asian refugees are fighting for jobs, education, and health programs. Find out how we've been changed. Read Vietnam 10 Years After the Fall this Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, April 28th through 30th, only in the Star and Tribune, where every edition's an extra.
Get set, Twins fans. Get closer to Minnesota Twins action at home on Spectrum Sports. Call your cable system today and get Spectrum Sports for a whole new season of explosive Minnesota Twins home action. Great camera work plus exclusive features and interviews. Don't miss it. Join Harmon Killebrew and me, Dick Bramer, for Minnesota Twins excitement, Spectrum Sports style. Call your cable system today. If you don't have cable, call the hotline, 623-1100. That's 623-1100. Get Spectrum Sports.
9 minutes now before 10 o'clock. We'll have news in 5 minutes. Former President Jimmy Carter with us, and a new book, Blood of Abraham, Insights into the Middle East. A very readable, unlike most books about things, subjects like this. They're very academic and sometimes difficult to read. This is one that's very readable for
and
average people like us.
And scholarly.
And yes, at the same time.
How can you be scholarly and readable at the same
time?
Well,
that's not easy, but
President
he did it.
Jimmy Carter has done it.
Mm. Well, when you have a peanut from a scholar.
What do the Democrats need to do to win some congressional elections next year? And
Predict, and you can mark down my words, that in 1986, we'll see the Democratic majority retained in the House and the achievement of a Democratic majority in the Senate. And I feel very hopeful about 1988. You've got three factors involved. One is Reagan's performance in the next 3 years, which I think is showing very strong signs of going down in popularity. Secondly, who the Republican nominee will be. No one knows. I certainly don't know. But I would guess that George Bush is the most likely one. It's his to lose. It's his if he wants it and can retain it. And he's not overwhelming with his charisma. He won't dominate the political scene with his vivacity. And he's not been very helpful to himself, even in his previous campaigns, which have not been very successful. So I don't think we'll have a formidable Republican opponent, likely. And, of course, the third and most important thing is who the Democrats will select and what that candidate will stand for. We've got some outstanding people on the horizon. Bill Bradley from New Jersey is one of my favorites. I don't even know if he's going to run. But he's a Rhodes Scholar, a famous professional basketball player, and one of the finest legislators I've ever known. Another one is Mario Cuomo, who's mentioned frequently because of his electrifying speech at the Democratic Convention, and he's another very intellectual leader who has a sensitivity of a governor of New York. Another one would be Sam Nunn from Georgia, solid on foreign policy and on an expert on defense, but had very good progressive credentials on civil rights and so forth. And there are others like Governor Graham from Florida, Bruce Babbitt from the West. So I think we've got a wide gamut of successful candidates. What should they stand for? Well, I hope they'll campaign and learn the sensitivities of this country, our fears and concerns and doubts and trepidations on the one hand, and our hopes and dreams and moral standards and ideals on the other. I think there has to be a combination of what might be called conservative approaches and also liberal approaches. I think the next successful candidate has got to be for a strong defense, for reduced deficits, for a stronger local and state government role as contrasted with the federal government, for the deregulation and high competition within the private enterprise system, those kind of things. On the other hand, I think the next president has to be devoted to a peaceful resolution of regional disputes, not the belligerent inclination that President Reagan has shown to avoid diplomacy and to use force or threats of force. I think we have to regain our reputation as a champion of a nuclear arms control, civil rights at home, human rights abroad, and a concern about the elderly, and a concern about education and things like that. So that kind of combination, I think, can bring to us victory in 1988. So if they'll only listen to my voice and take that advice that was given to you in about a couple of minutes, we'll win in 1988.
Walter Cronkite said, of all the presidents he's ever interviewed, you have the best mind, the smartest one.
I appreciate that. My only comment is I wish you'd said that when I was in the White House. And he was on the evening news every night.
Thank you very much.
I've enjoyed it.
President Jimmy Carter, former president, and with a new book, The Blood of Abraham, at your bookstore. News next on CCO.